Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour, NPR's roundtable podcast about what we're watching, reading, and listening to. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. On this week's show, the Avengers are back, fighting a very wry robot with some very special powers in Avengers Age of Ultron. We'll talk about the fighting, we'll talk about the exploding, we'll talk about the cities reduced or not reduced to dust, and I will warn you, we will talk about whether Thor is really necessary. And in our second segment, the bands that get no respect and the shows used as shorthand for everything that isn't cool, we'll talk about pop culture pariahs. And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week, so don't go away.
Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Check out NPR's Bullseye with Jesse Thorne. It's an excellent guide to the best in pop culture. Every week, Jesse Thorne interviews musicians, writers, filmmakers, comedians, and other creators about their creative work and lives. Find your new favorite TV shows, books, movies, and music, and gain new insights into the things you already love. Find Bullseye now at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
Avengers and Outcasts are on the docket today, but before we get started, let's go around the table here in historic Studio 44. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And with us this week is our pal Chris Klimek. Chris, when you are not talking about superheroes with Pop Culture Happy Hour, what do you do?
I write about movies and such for your blog and The Dissolve and The Village Voice, various and sundry.
I will say, I had a chance to see the little video essay that The Dissolve did off of your PG-13 piece for them previously.
We'll
throw a link to that. Now, Chris has been here a few times in the past to talk about superhero and other fightin' movies.
So this is not The Avengers, the Nick Hornby novel that we're gonna talk about?
Correct. The Avengers Age of Ultron, to give a little bit of setup, this is the 11th film in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And in the movie, Tony Stark accidentally lets loose an inventive and evil robot opponent called Ultron, voiced by James Spader. And it falls to the Avengers themselves, Iron Man, Captain America, the Hulk, Thor, and to a somewhat lesser extent, Black Widow and Hawkeye, particularly if you're going by the merch, to keep him from destroying the world. And also in the mix, you have a pair of twins, Pietro and Wanda Maximoff. Right, Glenn? Am
Nicely
I getting
done.
All this right?
Stick in the landing.
Also known as Quicksilver and Scarlet Witch. So that's a lot of people before you even throw in Paul Bettany as an android and cameos from a bunch of people who have been in other Marvel movies.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so this is a big cast. It's a big movie. Glenn, what is kind of your top-level takeaway from Age of Ultron?
All right. Linda Holmes, there is a comic book artist by the name of George Perez. George Perez drew The Avengers in the 70s. He also drew a comic called The New Teen Titans in the 80s. That's where I came to know him. And he is known for hyper-detailed, specific, very precise. His line is very precise. So, like Jack Kirby, who co-created The Avengers, would do huge human form in the center of the panel and a lot of stuff in the background, very impressionistic. This was not George Perez. George Perez was if there was gravel in the background. You saw every piece delineated very clearly. He also did big emotions between the characters, but it was in New Teen Titans. That's a comic that's about teenagers moping. So they're kind of out moping each other on one panel, and then they start screaming at each other at another panel. But you would turn the page, Linda Holmes, and you would get a two-panel center spread, splash pages, I guess, of just big superhero fight and action. And it would be so incredibly well composed and so detailed, with somebody on the bottom of page, lower left, page 18, zapping somebody, and the zap goes through the gutter and underneath a staple and up into the top of right of page 19. So immaculate and so capturing this action so precisely that you just wanted to fall inside it. It was like the nerdiest Where's Waldo ever, because wherever your eye roamed on the page, it would find something. And I saw a George Perez center spread splash page, except it was 72 feet high, it was moving, and there were jokes in it.
Uh-huh.
No film has captured that feeling, that feeling of delight that you get from big superhero action that is rendered like that until this film. We've had gestures towards it, but there are moments in this film when Whedon slows down the camera because he is a nerd, he is manipulative as all hell, and he knows exactly what people like me want, which is time to gawk. Time to marvel at what he's composed here. So several times over the course of this film.
Yeah, I thought it.
Yeah, right. I didn't.
The Teen Titans are a DC comic, though.
So I know.
Before we get the letters on that.
Yes, I know. But that's what I'm saying. He did it for The Avengers, too. He did it for Crisis on Infinite Earths. That's what brought me back into this film again and again, is just this incredible capturing of exactly the joy and the spectacle of superhero comics.
How about you, Chris?
Yeah, that splash page that Glenn mentioned is about 40 seconds into this movie when the five primary Avengers are sort of leaping in slow motion from left to right. I feel like all these movies in the superhero franchises sort of tick up in the second installment as long as the original director sticks around. It happened with the second Sam Raimi Spider-Man, which I think a lot of people, including me, still hold up as one of the best superhero films, even though it's not part of the current Marvel family. The second Bryan Singer X-Men, I thought this one recalled for me very much. The 20 or so storylines going in this film sort of produced this motion blur effect that mostly worked for me. I was confused a lot. I didn't mind being confused.
Yeah, I felt like this was like the payoff, the movie. Like, we've sat through 10 Marvel movies full of, I mean, I like a lot of them, but they are packed with a lot of exposition of who these characters are. This movie doesn't have to explain who these characters are. I feel like we're finally reaching a destination in a way with these interlocking characters and their interlocking stories. So while there is a certain amount of character development that goes on in this movie, some of it more indispensable than others, there's not this sense that we're telling an origin story anymore. Now we're just telling a big, fat, juicy story. And what I'm wondering is if this is the sweet spot. Mm-hmm. Like, we've now reached this perfect point where we've established who these people are, we've established why they're together, we've established what their conflicts are, and now we can tell a big rootin' tootin' wompin' story. But if you continue in that direction, it starts to crawl up its own butt a little bit. Like, Chris, you were talking about, like, the second one is often the juiciest.
Yeah.
Well, in some of those franchises you named, like, the third...
Pretty much all of them.
Like,
yeah, there's a drop-off.
Like,
yeah.
I hate The Dark Knight Rises. You know, Spider-Man 3 is not nearly as highly regarded as Spider-Man 2. There's often a step past this step that can be unsatisfying, but this, for me, was just an enormously entertaining kind of conclusion of endless exposition and just payoff to endless exposition.
Yeah. I liked this movie. I definitely enjoyed it. I had a great time. I would recommend it to anyone who, you know, is at all into these movies. I don't think that I liked it quite as much as you guys did. I think you guys are all like, you know, give it an A, and I'm more like, I would give it like a B plus. I think for me, my only hesitation about this movie is I do feel like its giganticness was a little overwhelming for me.
Sure.
And a little unchanging. And we've talked a little bit about the pacing of movies like this in the past, that it's very hard to create a movie that is satisfying if you put it at like a 7 on a scale of 10 and just leave it there,
mm-hmm.
you know, for 40 minutes at a time. And the good part about this movie, and I think a lot of Joss Whedon stuff in general, into the middle of the action, there are little bits of comedy. And I think that's extremely valuable. And were that not true, I would not have nearly the affection for this movie that I do.
Yeah, I had somebody on Twitter go by telling me, like, you will hate this movie. It's nothing but building smashing. But it's not.
It's not.
Yeah. But it...
There is a lot of building smashing.
Don't get me wrong. It's an enormous amount of building smashing. And I totally understand the point that it's on high. It's sort of set on high for enormous stretches of the movie. But because those scenes are punctuated with wit, it didn't feel nearly as deadening to me as a lot of these movies do.
I agree. And it didn't bother me. I really like all of these characters. And I've grown very fond of some of these portrayals that now I've seen in 4 or 5 movies. The Robert Downey Jr. portrayal of Iron Man I've now seen in this is the 5th movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Not counting, I don't remember if there are cameos or whatever, but like the 5th one in which it's a main part of the movie. I'm very fond of that performance and I really enjoy it. I really like the Chris Evans performance as
mm-hmm.
Captain America. And we've talked about that since the first one, that's a trickier role than I think sometimes it gets credit for. I like all of these performances. I like these characters and I like the movie. But I will admit that I probably could have done with a little less of some of the kind of, you know, endless shots of things crashing and
sure. mm-hmm.
just not because I was particularly bothered by it, but just because it did feel like we weren't making progress.
Yeah, the smart thing that Whedon does here is he has a villain who is not bombastic, who is not cackling with evil glee. He has a very low-key, not low-key, but low-key, insouciant, one might even say,
yeah.
villain who what that tells you is that he doesn't care about you. Mm-hmm. You're not his agenda. He's got bigger fish to fry.
Right.
And what that does is it really modulates the film in certain key places. So it's not just shouty. There's actually sort of layers to it. And the performance, the motion capture performance of James Spader as Ultron, there are these moments where he's talking to another character the way that somebody who is not a robot would be talking to another character,
yeah,
with the eye movements and snide asides. That's just a hell of a lot of fun. It's also important, the reason that the big smashy doesn't bother me in this film the way it did in, say, Man of Steel, is because they save lives. Mm-hmm. This is how you set the stakes. When it's just this giant spectacle, you need to kind of locate us in the humanity and show not only that they're doing it, but that it's important to them. We get in every scene how important it is for them to rescue innocents.
Yeah, when you know, allowing for the fact that it takes a couple years for a movie like this to ramp up, this feels like the first one that is almost a direct response to the complaints about Man of Steel, because mm-hmm. there is so much lip service about protecting civilians, getting yep. them out of the way,
they're
the finale with the lifeboats. And it's, you know, it's kind of like this carbon offset that lets you enjoy the carnage, that they're paying so much dialogue about taking care of the civilians.
I think that's right.
And I mean, it does become a theme of the movie. To call it a lip service is to do it an injustice.
Yeah, I mean, there it does fall a little bit victim to remembering Godzilla, where there'd be like one Moppet, you know, mm-hmm. with like a dog
right.
or something, and they would save that Moppet, and it doesn't matter that like hundreds of thousands of
yeah.
people were inevitably killed. This movie does a much better job of giving you the sense that there is humanity interwoven with this destruction. Another thing I really like about this movie, shifting topics slightly, is I have typically found Hawkeye in particular to be a very, very, very dull character. Mm-hmm. And I know, Glenn, you are on record. You are not a Jeremy Renner fan.
Not.
Joss Whedon, who you know, did, obviously, among other things, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, did a lot on that show with the fact that Xander is noble and heroic and largely valueless from mm-hmm. a superpower standpoint. And Hawkeye shoots arrows really well. That's his amazing superpower compared to people who can, like, do radically, radically more. I like the fact that this movie plays with that and makes him a central character while acknowledging that he is of much less use from a
right.
from a heavy lifting standpoint.
He's the one who gets wounded severely in the first scene, and Scarlett Johansson has this line where they're stitching him up, where she says, "Oh, well, pretending we need this guy really helps to hold the team together."
Mm-hmm.
And she says that for him to hear, but it is a, you know, kind of a funny acknowledgement of the ridiculousness of his presence.
Yeah, I was impressed by him for the first time ever at good old Potato Nose Bowl of Bland. He actually acquitted himself very well in this film.
Yeah, I do still think that this movie has some problems with character balance. I mm-hmm. think that, you know, as I said before, I think the characters who are best served by the way Whedon writes this story are Tony Stark and Captain America. And mm-hmm. I think the fundamental conflict at the center of Whedon's perception of this universe, and in fact, it also is in some of the Iron Man movies and the Captain America movies, but I think this entire stretch of movies, the central conflict is the idea, is the conflicting ideas of American exceptionalism and patriotism in Captain America and in Tony Stark.
Mm-hmm.
The sort of the old-fashioned sacrificing naturally good versus the wealthy playboy, naturally selfish but learning to be good. It's a very interesting conflict, and I always want to be in that conflict. I always want to be with those two guys. I find that the more these movies wander away from that relationship, there is sort of one central scene between the two of them where they're literally chopping wood and chatting. That is my center for this movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's my emotional, like, central place for this movie. I always want more of those conversations and more of the conversations between the characters. And that's the other reason why I get distracted by the long, long sequence of things crashing into things, is that I want a little different balance. And I do think that they continue to have trouble serving all of these characters well.
Sure.
I do agree with you that they serve Hawkeye better in this movie than certainly in the previous movie, where he was hypnotized for a large part of it.
Like, immediately, as soon as they introduce him, so we don't even know who he's supposed to be.
Exactly. You know, there's been a lot of talk about Black Widow and the fact that she gets into this, you know, they're setting up this kind of romantic storyline with her and Bruce Banner. But for me, the one that I don't get is Thor, who I just think is so unbelievably unnecessary in these movies. There is I don't think, and I could be wrong about this, particularly, I think Joss Whedon does not give a horse's patoot about Thor and has no, like, interest in that or idea about that, doesn't understand a way to fit it into all of these conflict, right? You can see Hawkeye is kind of the one who in this movie is a little more about what's the relationship of this to real life and family and stuff like that. You can see the interest in Bruce Banner as far as the anger and the emotion and the self-control and that thing I was talking about with Cap and Tony Stark. I don't know what Thor is for in these movies. I think he is so boring in these movies. Oh. You could drop Thor out of these movies and I would not miss him for 1 second. You could have them carrying around an upturned mop and it would have the same.
Oh, man.
For me, it would be the same thing. It'd
be a very
I feel you on this. Thor 2 is the only Marvel movie that I have intentionally skipped so far because I just don't care. But I do think he is funny in this movie to the extent that he is in it, which is not very much.
Right.
He has, like Banner is worried that he might have hurt someone when he was the Hulk, and he has that line about, the Valhalla echoes with the screams of your victims, and then he realizes that's not what he wants to hear.
Yeah, right, that's funny. That's fun.
He works on that level. There's another joke he has about the hammer and how you use the hammer.
Yeah, there's a good
that works nicely. But I think Whedon, agrees with you because he does disappear for a good 45-minute chunk of this film on this side quest, which has something to do, which is pure setup. But your point about the conflict between Cap and Tony is interesting because that leads us to what's coming next. The next Captain America film is Civil War, which in the comics at least was a direct conflict between two styles of superheroing, between Captain America and Iron Man. And then after that, it's Infinity War, which is the thing with the gems and the gauntlet and the guy with the blue face. And yeah, that's a thing. That
yeah.
Probably
we'll
don't have
waited 6 years to find out who that guy is.
Yeah,
oh boy.
We know who that guy is, what he's going to be doing and how he's going to
fit.
Okay,
well, you and I know who that guy is.
That's true. Okay.
Yeah. So did we have feelings about the pair of twins played by Elizabeth Olsen and Aaron Taylor-Johnson, known to Pop Culture Happy Hour fans as playing Ford Brody in Godzilla, the tiny little sport vehicle that is the Ford Brody? What will it take
puttering around your action movie into a Ford Brody?
What will it take to get you into a Ford Brody today?
Uh-huh.
But in this, he plays Quicksilver. She plays Scarlet Witch, as they say at one point. He's fast and she's weird.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And she's going to single-handedly, Elizabeth Olsen will bring back voguing onto America's dance floor. Because that's what she does. She vogues for justice.
Mm-hmm.
As Chris mentioned, little Boris and Natasha are moving in there. But yeah.
That's how people talk in Skolkovia.
Sokovia.
Sokovia.
I like Skolkovia, though.
Sokovia. It's like a Socking. Bank.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
A word, please, for the costuming in this film. Michael Chabon, back in 2008, had a big essay in The New Yorker called Secret Skin, which was about the superhero costume as a cultural artifact and also as like a physical artifact, what it stands for and what it actually looks like. And he made the point that in comics, the superhero costume is basically just a naked body with some lines drawn on it and then colored in, because no fabric adheres to musculature or curves in quite that way. Spandex obscures. You think you can just put something in spandex and do it. We've had two trends happening. One, which is a trend that Chris has talked about before, which is about the development of the male body into this incredible hypertrophic musculature,
right,
with 3% body fat. That's one trend,
right,
for the American movie. And then some kind of transformational advance in textiles where we get a specific kind of athletic wear, which will go unnamed here, but that is all over this damn movie and is about wicking technology, let's say, that adheres to, say, the pectoral muscle of a Chris Evans in a way that is exactly like we have achieved comic book iconography. There's that scene where he's cutting wood, where he's wearing a t-shirt that does exactly what a superhero costume is supposed to do. What hath God wrought? We have come.
Well, you know, this takes us a little bit into another thing that I wanted to touch on, which is the portrayal of Black Widow, of Natasha Romanoff, which, played by Scarlett Johansson, who I actually really like that performance too. And there's been a lot of talk about, she's the only Avenger, female Avenger, that you're getting in this movie. You know, she's an assassin, she's got a love story, she's got a story that ultimately touches on some issues regarding her reproductive life and all this stuff. And she also has this incredibly tight spandex costume, right? And on the one hand, I'm always happy to object along with anyone else to objectification of whoever. But I was looking at this movie thinking, I don't know that she's objectified in this movie any more than Chris Evans.
Oh,
it's mostly him, right? Because Thor is in a freaking bathrobe. And,
you know,
and
I can't
Stark
believe
it. Tony Stark,
I'm going to be the one to say this, but it did not seem like we had a lot of shirtlessness for.
We had no
for
shirtlessness
a
in that
movie.
Point of fact. Let me weigh in on this. We had no shirtlessness.
But it's not. Well, it's not just skin. I mean, she's not revealing skin either.
The clothes.
Using the clothes to be like, get a load of that? And I think they are with her, and they are with him.
They
too.
Totally are. And yeah.
it just doesn't work on you, Chris.
That wood chopping scene is
don't assume
effectively shirtlessness. It does the work that shirtlessness would do in a movie like this on people like me.
Maybe that's why I liked it so much. Uh-huh. I've always really liked the presentation of Black Widow. I've always really appreciated the fact that of all the Avengers, she's the one who's a hand fighter. I think that's cool for your one female Avenger. But I sat down to start to write about this week, and I realized there's nothing you can do with the only female Avenger that's not going to be troublesome in some way, because that's what it is to speak with only one, to give only one window.
Right.
No matter what you're seeing through that window, it seems in some way unrepresentative. Because I thought to myself, what would happen if they had swapped her out with any of the other stories in the movie? But if she had Tony Stark's story, there would be a sense of like, of course, and she's the one who screws up and causes all the trouble, and now you have to have a rescue. If she had Thor's story, it would be the sort of like disappears in the middle of the movie and doesn't come back until the end. If she had Captain America's story, it would be the sort of like keep everyone's behavior in line, behavior cop story.
Right.
If she had Hulk's story, it would be the kind of can't control, superpower is can't control my feelings, right? And if she had Hawkeye's story, it would be, you know, is conflicted
is
about feelings.
Is gigantically superfluous.
Well, no, but it would be has conflicted feelings about work-life balance, we might say, right? And like, no matter what story
he wants
was,
to have it all, it faces every woman.
No matter what story it is, if there's only one, it's going to annoy me at some level because I want to see more of those stories told.
Yep.
And the fundamental fact that like this story is very specific, parts of this story are very specific to the fact that she's a woman, right?
Saturday Night Live addressed this, I thought, in a pretty funny way. When did you see that?
I did.
I brought a clip. I don't know if it makes sense to do a little snippet.
Yeah, I think
of that,
we can.
But,
I think we can hear a little bit.
All right,
of the Black
Jessica,
Widow.
That was number five.
The only thing missing in Black Widow's life,
such a klutz,
was love.
Hey, I'm Ultron.
Black Widow.
You wanna grab a coffee?
I don't really have time to date any guys now.
So. What about robots?
I thought that was funny too. But you wind up in a weird situation. I don't know. So here's what I want to know: is there an upcoming movie where the team is the team that you see at the end of this movie, which is a slightly different team?
That is unclear.
Okay.
That is unclear.
Fair enough. You heard it right from the horse's mouth.
Two more
it
Avengers films coming, but where it's unclear is exactly to the roster.
All right. Well, I will be curious to hear what people think. It made an enormous amount of money, so we know that a lot of you have seen it. So come and find us on Facebook or on the blog and tell us what you think. Tweet at us, NPRPCHH, and tell us what you thought. And when we come back, we're going to talk about pop culture pariahs. We pick on them. We make their lives miserable. How do they find themselves in this situation? And yes, we are going to talk about Nickelback. So we will be right back.
Hi, this is Jeff Whaley, and I'm calling from Boston, Massachusetts. And now, we'd like to thank one of our sponsors who helped make today's program possible, Oyster. Oyster would like you to know about their app, where you can subscribe to read as many books as you'd like for a monthly fee. With over 1 million titles in every genre, from Harry Potter to The Goldfinch, Oyster allows you to discover great literature. It's designed to feel personal with editors' book picks, unique reader themes, and recommendations based on what you like. For a free 30-day trial to Oyster Unlimited, visit oysterbooks.com/NPR.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. So our other topic this week started with a piece that Stephen wrote for his NPR music advice column, The Good Listener. I hope you're reading it. the column had gotten the question of why some bands seem to receive scorn that's disproportionate to the actual need for it. Or, as Stephen headlined the piece, why do people hate Nickelback so much? So, Stephen, can you talk a little bit about this column and kind of what came out of it?
I thought it was a really interesting question, and I tried to pick apart two separate ideas. One is the specifics of why Nickelback draws so much scorn, and there's a very specific set. They're kind of a harbinger of the copy of a copy of a copy, the way grunge kind of devolved into Creed-style, right, self-important bloviating.
Which we talked about, by the way, in our previous episode about rock music, which you can find within our last couple months of shows.
Yeah, and you know, and we've talked, you know, before about Hunga Donga Dang bands, uh-huh, and just how lousy and generic a lot of that music is. But I also tried to get to the larger point of the way fans often kind of rove in packs, and how when, you know, an enormously popular band reaches a little bit of a tipping point where they start to fall out of fashion, you sometimes get this mass shift against it, particularly online hatred, but, you know, fans just kind of turning on them in droves to the point where there's not really a popular position to take defending it.
Yeah.
And you get to the point where certain, there are many bands that fall into this category, but there are also actors who fall into this category, where there becomes almost no point in defending it. And so you get this very disproportionate pendulum swing where there's just massive, kind of almost weirdly unanimous seeming hatred of like a Gwyneth Paltrow.
Sure.
Who is, you know, certainly has her... There are elements to Gwyneth Paltrow's personality that are insipid.
Sure.
But where, like, hating Gwyneth Paltrow has become, like, a blood sport.
Yeah.
And so it kind of got us into this idea of pop culture pariahs. People think it's a novel position to, like, I hate Coldplay more than everyone else.
Right, sure.
But, like, Coldplay just is so disproportionately pummeled. I wrote the headline, "Why Do People Hate Nickelback So Much?" And I knew that when I went to the comments section...
Yeah.
You were going to see 457 comments that just say, because they suck, duh.
Right.
You know, instead of engaging with, like, do I really hate this band more than I hate so many other things?
Right.
Pariah is a loaded word because it connotes moral judgment, right? It's like the community has decided and you're an outcast.
Right.
And I was thinking about this in terms of comedians and comedy and even hack jokes. Like when something becomes a punchline, it's like Nickelback is a punchline.
Yeah.
You don't have to think about it. It stands, it represents something in the cultural consciousness as it means hacky, it means bad. In comedy circles, in comedy nerd circles anyway, something becomes a hack joke when it is two things: lazy. It is perceived as being not individual, idiosyncratic, not reflecting a single person's voice, but sort of milquetoast, bland, insipid. And also, this is the really important thing, popular. And that's what Stephen touched on with Nickelback. Huge popularity is very important to this. It wouldn't exist without it, because you have to feel like you are standing up against the crowd. You have to feel like you are the contrarian, as Stephen wrote in his piece. You have to feel like it because there's power in that.
Right.
Comedians like Carrot Top and Gallagher are punchlines, are considered hacks because they're prop comedians, which has fallen out of favor. But it's also because they rest on puns and jokes, which people perceive as lazy. They're also hugely popular among a certain cohort of the population that people who consider themselves comedy nerds emphatically do not belong in.
Right.
And in both the cases of Carrot Top and Gallagher, they also make honk loads of money.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Like they have deals in Vegas that pay tens of millions of dollars. So there's still a sense that you're not kicking an underdog, even though like Carrot Top and Gallagher have become very lazy punchlines.
Right.
To say like, you know who sucks? Carrot Top is not a novel observation, but you're not picking on someone no one's ever heard of.
Right, right. What do you think, Chris?
Yeah, I think the alternate name for this topic would be everything Chris Klimek has ever liked. You know, so the attributes that I sort of bonded to these pop cultural figures in a sort of way that makes me feel compelled to defend them no matter what they do, uh-huh, and no matter how old I get. Massive ambition, massive success, massive perceived hubris.
Yes.
Jessica, if you could please play clip 4.
Mom, Dad, there's no way that I can express to you what I'm feeling right now. My heart is full to bursting, except to say, I'm the king of the world!
Oh.
Yeah, listen to you groan. Listen to you groan when the guy who made the two most successful films of all time is up there collecting his Oscar for Best Director because everybody hates him.
Okay, so that is James Cameron.
That is James Cameron at the podium.
Collecting his Oscar for Titanic.
Yes, which comes at the... That is a terribly misjudged moment. It sounds awful.
It comes...
But it's the moment.
No, that is the moment I chose to play. It comes after 2 solid minutes of him thanking other people.
Mm-hmm. Of course. Okay.
But it is the moment when... It's the moment that crystallized the...
Exactly. No, that is the moment that got him, you know, forever branded as a jerk, following on the heels of all these stories about him being mean to Kate Winslet on the set of Titanic.
That also helped.
Okay, but consider, when you're prior to the release of your movie, you have a story every day for a year and a half about how you are going to bankrupt 2 studios, how this is, you know, you are making Cleopatra plus Heaven's Gate crossed with 1941. And then the movie comes out, is one that critics love, that becomes has like a bigger 6th weekend than it had a first weekend.
I love Titanic.
I love Titanic too. I mean, look, the James Cameron movies that I really love are the first 2 Terminators that he wrote and directed, Aliens, the deeply underrated The Abyss. You know, he is a nerdy sci-fi guy who started off working in Roger Corman's shop and made good. So it is only that he has been so successful and thus overexposed that people kind of hate him. I'll give you another one. Here's a quote. "I don't mean to sound arrogant, but even at this stage, I do feel we are meant to be one of the great groups. There's a certain spark, a certain chemistry that was special about the Stones, about the Who, and the Beatles, and I think it's also special about...
You
anybody?
Too? I was going to say you too.
Yeah, it's no surprise this comes from one Paul Hewson, better known as Bono. He is saying this to James Henke and Rolling Stone in 1981 when he is 20 years old.
Mm-hmm.
I submit to you that he has made good on this admittedly arrogant claim. You know, you two have survived for several generations, continually reinventing themselves. Most recently,
but
we saw...
pariahs.
No. The backlash to their Apple deal, where everybody who has an iPhone or has an iTunes account got their album for free.
Oh, yeah.
I think it was way out of proportion. If Beyonce had done that, I don't think it would have been nearly the outcry about, you know, invasion of privacy or, you know, just about how people want to curate their own music collections. All perfectly valid objections, but I think it was the fact that it happened to be someone or a band with a singer who people, even me, cringe when he gets behind a podium.
Yeah.
Made that furor much louder.
I'm really glad you brought up U2.
Well, and I'm really glad you brought up that James Cameron speech, because I have on my list of things that specifically has a tendency to incite this reaction, catchphrases.
Mm-hmm.
And I think anytime you give people something that they hear it over and over and all of a sudden they turn a corner and now it's like, now I hate it. I was thinking about the Cameron Crowe film, Jerry Maguire, which when Jerry Maguire came out, the reception of that film, as I experienced it at the time, it's a weirder little movie than people remember it being. It has some really kind of offbeat, interestingly paced stuff in it. It has some really dark stuff emotionally in it in certain places, but it got reduced down to you had me at hello and show me the money.
Yeah.
And as soon as those two things happened, you lose the sense of the actual thing and it just becomes the sum of these catchphrases. And I think honestly, if James Cameron had done all the same things, and I think it is an exaggeration to say James Cameron is a pariah, but but if he had done exactly the same things and that movie hadn't had that one phrase that became something where, you know, years later on The Office, when they all went on the U.S. Office, when they all went on a booze cruise and they were getting on the cruise, Jim Halpert said of Michael Scott, played by Steve Carell, he says, he gets on the front of the boat and says, "I'm king of the world in the first hour or I give you my next paycheck." He says to the camera guys. They get on the boat and he does it like in the first 30 seconds. And Jim looks down at his watch because that becomes a jerk faces thing to say. Then it stands for the entire thing just because it became a catchphrase.
You like me. You really like me.
You like me, you really like me is one.
Yeah.
Sally
Fields'
Oscar speech. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a very understandable thing to say, I think.
And a very uncalculated thing to say. Like,
that's
that has to be sincere. If you had thought about it for a second, that's not what you would say. And, you know, but that's the price of genuinely exposing yourself in front of, I don't know, however many people watch the Oscars.
But the stiff way that Cameron delivered, "I'm king of the world," tells you that he had it in his back pocket, which makes it worse.
Oh, absolutely.
Makes it much worse.
No, that was not uncalculated.
I'm sure.
Yeah. Well, it also,
I mean, I deliberately chose his least flattering moments. You know, I mean, I don't like it when Bono gets behind a podium either, because I'm going to have to defend him tomorrow. You know.
It's interesting, though. The Sally Field one has all this emotion behind it. And part of it is that the James Cameron one doesn't seem to have as much emotion.
Right.
I do want to bring up one thing with bands that comes up a lot, because I was really trying to pull apart why, for example, Nickelback has gathered more of this than some of its kind of equally bland peers. I really think there's something about bands' names that roll off the tongue in a certain way, where if you say them a certain way, it's venomous.
Well, you're right. And they become punchlines just because Hoobastank.
I have written down Hoobastank.
Hoobastank.
Which is very, I mean,
Limp Bizkit.
You call yourself Hoobastank, you kind of signed up for it.
Smash Mouth.
But like there's a certain cluster of syllables that sounds, when you say it derisively, it clanks in a way. I think even Mumford & Sons. Mumford & Sons.
Well, and like I just was saying, Smash Mouth.
Smash Mouth.
So how is it then that Pearl Jam has survived? I mean, it took me a long time to figure out what the name Pearl Jam is referring to. But this is a band that has, a lot of credibility. And
I think Pearl Jam gets there in part by being a better band, in part by being a little bit more nobly intentioned, a little bit more kind of fan service, a little bit more like we played for 3 hours even though I almost died. You know, there's more nobility to Pearl Jam. Pearl Jam got there a little sooner.
In terms of that
genre. Pearl Jam is imitated just as much as Kurt Cobain. You know, that Honga Donga Dang voice we joke about on the show is much more Eddie Vedder than Kurt Cobain.
It's very much Eddie Vedder.
It's Eddie Vedder with a little skosh of Lane Staley from Alice in Chains.
Right,
another early arrival that there were degraded copies of degraded copies.
Yeah, I don't know if this really qualifies as a pariah, but another thing I wanted to say is that I think the other thing that drives pariahification of a thing is what does it allow you as the excluder and ostracizer to convey about yourself?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And it's an unconventional pariah. Stay with me here. Selfie stick.
Yes!
Right.
Because
it was an instant pariah.
First of all, it was an instant pariah. It's not like that went through some phase in which it was not. And all of a sudden it was. Okay. I am completely okay with selfie sticks are silly. They get in the way if you're at the zoo, if that's something you do. They get in the way. They're awkward.
I run through the zoo. They are very much in the way, more than the children.
I get all that.
More than the children. I like them.
I understand
even less
that
than
the children,
children
are, just a hazard that you accept.
Children are necessary evil.
They really are.
Okay, but cameras for many, many, many years have had self-timers on them. The entire purpose of which is to take a picture of a bunch of people that you are in. That is the purpose of self-timers. Most cameras have them. Your cell phone camera very likely has one, even if you've never found it in the functions. Not to mention the act of walking up to strangers and saying, could you take a picture of us, which people have done for decades. Those things come from exactly the same impulse as the selfie stick, which is, I want to take a picture of myself. That is all it is. There is nothing modern downfall of society, fall of Rome about the selfie stick that is not also true.
Nero was taking a selfie as Rome
of
burned.
Self-timers on cameras. And yet somehow the selfie stick has empowered people to sort of say, look at these monsters who wish a photo of themselves and their friends. They are the worst.
Selfie stick is, if it hits every single one of these categories we've mentioned, though. There's hubris. There's, especially with the bands, there's an element of self-importance.
Right.
Because so many of these bands, Nickelback is a very stern, self-serious band. U2 is incredibly self-important. And the name, the fact that the name is selfie stick,
also, I would add,
which is cloying.
Right. Laziness. It also impacts that laziness thing where you could just do it, but they don't.
Well, yeah, it's a pull.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay, but the point that I was trying to get at is, I think a lot of the affection that people have for complaining about selfie sticks is what it allows you to imply about yourself, right?
How real you are.
Right. I'm much too down to earth to take my own photo with a selfie stick. I think the fact that the young people want to take photos of themselves with selfie sticks is just the absolute worst. And it's like, well, what were you and your friends doing to memorialize your vacations? What were you doing? Like buying a little stuffed dolphin at SeaWorld?
In the Nickelback column, I talk about the vanity inherent in these pylons. And there's total vanity inherent in talk about selfie sticks.
And the vanity comes up in a film like Garden State. The perception of Zach Braff, he's our comedy guy, and he's what's he doing here? He's writing and directing a movie, and
and how dare you?
How dare you is a big part of this, and the vehemence that people reacted to that film with splashed over onto the shins.
Yeah, the optics of all of this are really complicated, and this is another one where I'm very much looking forward to hearing what the people have to say. So find us on Twitter or Facebook or the blog, and let us know what you think. And when we come back, we are going to get to our favorite segment of every week. What is making us happy this week? So stick around.
Hi, I'm Megan, and I'm calling from Washington, D.C. Support for Pop Culture Happy Hour and this message are from TastingRoom.com, the only wine club that fits your personal taste. Here's how it works. Tasting Room sends you a kit with sample-sized bottles of wine. You sip each one, log on to their site, and tell them which wines you liked best. Tasting Room then picks wines for you based on your taste. You get your first full case 1 month later. The shipments come every 3 months from when you started. Visit tastingroom.com/NPR for the wine club where your taste is the only one that matters.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It is our favorite time. It is the time we talk about what is making us happy this week. Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
Well, we talked last week about pop culture rabbit holes, and I was reminded recently when I was in Denver for the Denver Music Summit, I ran into a guy named Sean Moeller, who is one of the curators at Daytrotter. And Daytrotter, if you haven't seen it before, is one of the great music rabbit holes on the internet. If you don't know it, it's a website archiving studio performances. They're based in a town called Rock Island, Illinois, and bands come through there all the time and perform kind of, you know, little miniature sessions. And they not only archive the performances, but create this beautiful hand-drawn art that goes with it. And it's been around since, I believe, 2007. It's one of the several bands perform in strange places sites that actually predates Tiny Desk Concerts. Daytrotter predates them. La Blogothèque, the Takeaway shows predate them. The Black Cab sessions predate them. So when people talk about the Tiny Desk Concerts as if we were like fabulous originals, we need to throw some props to sites that came before us and are still at it. Daytrotter is wonderful, and they didn't lift it all the way, but they recently lifted a good chunk of their paywall. In about 2011, they had to put all these like thousands of performances behind a paywall, and you would have to be a member in order to download them. You still, if you want to download them, have to pay kind of a nominal fee, but they lifted it so that these like 9,000 performances, you can listen to half of each one. And that is a great way to go down a massive, massive rabbit hole of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of hours of unique performances. Basically, any band that has ever had the word indie attached to its name probably has a Daytrotter session. They're just wonderful. If you have a band that not very many people have heard of, or that at some time not very many people have heard of it, you will find an amazing performance archived on Daytrotter. It is a wonderful website, and I was reminded of it recently, A, from running into this guy, and B, from the fact that they just did this change in their policy where you can access so much of this music for free.
Wonderful. Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
Three things. First, Penny Dreadful is back on Showtime. Hey. We talked about this before. Eva Green, Timothy Dalton, a bunch of other people, late 19th century London, vampires and Frankenstein's monsters and the picture of Dorian Gray, a bunch of things. It's just incredibly atmospheric and wonderful and over the top and amazing and very fun. We also just got a trailer for an upcoming BBC and BBC America miniseries called Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, which is based on the Susanna Clarke book from, I think, 2005, a tremendous book about, from the early part of the 19th century in London and environs, about the Napoleonic Wars with two rival magicians changing the course of history. I remember almost nothing about the plot of this book.
You never do.
But I remember the voice, the tone, this very assured mood that is set because the narrator has this Jane Austen, Charles Dickens sort of, here is how we as a culture, as a society work. And it was just so restrained, but very funny, and I hope they capture some of that somehow. But the main thing, of course, is that Free Comic Book Day was last Saturday. We just saw all kinds of photos of people who took their Rugrats and got free comics. And every time somebody would mention on the Twitter feed that they were going into a comic book store for the first time or trying comics, it just warmed my black and tiny heart. So
it was pretty great.
It was pretty great.
It was pretty great. If you are somebody who sometimes checks out our Facebook feed, there are a bunch of photos that people were nice enough to send us of themselves and their kids and their haul, H-A-U-L, from Comic Book Day. Free Comic Book Day, so I agree with you, Glenn. All right, thank you, Glenn Weldon. Chris Klimek, what is making you happy this week, buddy?
Well, I too believe in lining up multiple happiness delivery systems so that the failure of any one does not necessitate that the mission be scrubbed. Andy Weir's debut novel, The Martian, which I was listening to on my trip out in California to go to Jet Propulsion Laboratory and China Lake Naval Air Weapon Station and some other space exploration-related sites. This is a guy who's a computer programmer by trade and, you know, couldn't get a publisher, couldn't get an agent. Started publishing this in segments on his personal blog in 2009. Eventually was published last year, hit the New York Times bestseller list. Ridley Scott is directing the movie currently. Drew Goddard, who we know from Cabin in the Woods and Daredevil, wrote the screenplay. The story is about an astronaut who gets stranded on Mars and has to figure out how to survive, how to maybe get back, what's NASA doing for him. And very, very grounded in science. A lot of math in this book. I know I'm really selling it. But the narrator, he also has a terrific sense of humor. You know, I would just be panicking and wallowing in the existential horror of being alone on a planet. And this guy distracts himself from his extremely long hours of survival by figuring out, you know, what he needs to do to convert the hydrazine in his rocket ship into oxygen that he can breathe. And the book isn't great on characterization. That part's a little thin, but it's just such a smart idea and so well executed that I recommend it. That's Andy Weir's The Martian. But you cannot listen to audiobooks the whole time you're driving around Southern California. The final thing that's making me happy, Jess, if you could please play number 6. This was a hit the year that I turned 16.
Oh boy.
This is Positive K's. Yep. I've Got a Man, thanks to K-Day 93.5, Los Angeles's old school hip-hop station. I can fill in some of those gaps. This is a really, really fun song that I've had stuck in my head since I heard it. I don't know how I missed it in 1992. Well, I kind of do.
Yeah. The second time that song has been featured on this show, if it happens one more time,
no!
It becomes the featured song. It becomes an official
song. It becomes
song.
Our official. Yeah.
It's true. It's absolutely
there
true.
There are worse things than having that become our official
That would
song.
Be great.
It's true. Thank you very much, Chris Klimek. First of all, making me happy this week, Stephen and I last week were in New York for an event that NPR held with WBEZ and WNYC, where we got to meet some fans of our show and some fans of other people's show and some other people who make podcasts, and it was really fun. I wanted to say to those of you who came out for that and met me and Stephen while I tried to stand against various walls and posts because it's what I do. I just wanted to say it was really, really nice to meet all of you, and that was fun. And
oh,
Stephen and I had a really good time and got to meet a lot of other good folks.
Yeah,
so,
I keep not meeting jerks at these things.
I know. It's the worst. So that's A. And then B is it's not exactly a... It's not an offbeat thing to be happy about Mad Men, particularly as Mad Men is in the process of kind of winding down. We have, as we tape this, two more episodes left of Mad Men before the end of the series. The beginning of this run of 7 episodes was really slow for me. I didn't dislike it, but it was slow and it was not that much fun. And I was spending a lot of time around people I don't care about in the story. The last two episodes, including Sunday night's episode, which was called Lost Horizon, although they have had deep, deep elements of melancholy, as Mad Men always does, have been really fun episodes, I think, to watch, both because you're seeing characters do the things that I am there to see those characters do, right? Don Draper, as we get closer to the end, is kind of doing that weird thing he does where he's thinking about what the next phase of his life is going to be. And you get that open question of whether he's going to decide to do something really different with his life as he's done once before. You get the story of particularly how the women in the office are responding to what is and is not change in the way that they're treated. And in Sunday night's episode in Lost Horizon, there was a sequence in which, this is a little spoilery, so if you're behind on Mad Men, you can skip to the end of the show. It's almost over anyway. Peggy Olson was at the old office without her desk in the new office and wound up hanging out with Roger Sterling, who was also hanging out in the old office, playing the organ that for some reason they have in the office. There's a little kind of showmaking joke that to me was very unusual for this show, which is this bit where Peggy is walking around the office and it's very scary and it sounds like it's scary, creepy music. And then it turns out it's Roger playing the organ, which is a real shift in, I mean, that's a joke where you're, that's a, almost a fourth wall breaking joke, yeah, in a certain way.
It's like the drummer in Birdman.
It's exactly like the drummer in Birdman. And I thought it was really funny, but all of a sudden do this amazing sequence, which I don't even feel like I can give away, do this amazing little series of scenes together that culminate eventually in Peggy going to the new office for her first day. And the shot of her coming down the hall is one of the best shots I have ever seen on television. And I mean that. One of the most effective, instantly iconic things I've ever seen on television, that the minute you see it, you think, that is an iconic shot. That is going to be one of the two or three things people take away from this entire seven-season Emmy-nominated, Emmy-winning series is going to be that shot. Mm-hmm. And it's been great to see them do a couple of really fun, really effective, really cool episodes as they get close to the end. So I am just so happy that I am enjoying watching that show as it is heading toward its conclusion. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow the show at NPR PCHH. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen or Glenn at GH Weldon. You can follow Chris at CT Klimek. That's CTKLIMEK. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy. You can follow our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are bobbing your head to right now. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you right back here next week.
Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Check out NPR's Bullseye with Jesse Thorne. It's an excellent guide to the best in pop culture. Every week, Jesse Thorne interviews musicians, writers, filmmakers, comedians, and other creators about their creative work and lives. Find your new favorite TV shows, books, movies, and music, and gain new insights into the things you already love. Find Bullseye now at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.